Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we've got a discussion about the new fantasy epic, The Green Knight, directed by David Lowery and starring Dev Patel. Connor Allen Smith joins the show for that, and for the Arkansas listeners, we've got a sneak preview of a couple of film festivals coming up in the state. That is the Bentonville Film Festival, which is happening August 2nd through the 8th, and the Fort Smith International Film Festival, August 13th through the 14th. And after that, we continue our Wong Kar-wai marathon with Omaya Jones, looking at the second film in the series, Days of Being Wild. Stay tuned. We are going to talk all about the incredibly exciting new A24 film, The Green Knight, but before we do, we're going to talk film festivals for just a minute. Depending on when you're listening to this, the Bentonville Film Festival is probably happening right now. It's August 2nd through the 8th, both in person and virtually. And this year, the lineup has some really cool stuff, including some Arkansas filmmakers and some people you may recognize from this podcast. More on that in just a moment. The Bentonville Film Festival, or BFF as it's called, started in 2015 and it's run by the Bentonville Film Foundation. Actor Gina Davis serves as the chair of that foundation alongside President Wendy Guerrero and festival producer Jason Netter. What I really like about this festival is their emphasis on diversity and inclusion. If you take a look at their website, you'll find this statement on their about page. It says, "The Bentonville Film Foundation is a nonprofit organization focused on promoting underrepresented voices of diverse storytellers. We champion female, non-binary, LGBTQIA+, Black, Indigenous, people of color, and people with disabilities voices in entertainment and media." I love that, and I love that they regularly showcase local Arkansas filmmakers as well. At this year's Regional Shorts Showcase, you'll find several Arkansas projects, including these two, that feature some Art House Garage regulars. First up is Lullaby, that stars Sophie Barnes, who you may recognize from the recent Zola episode, and she's been on before that as well. And also in that film is James Basham, who's been on to talk about The Lighthouse and Marriage Story, and I think at least one or two more. Another film that's playing is called Self-Portrait, and then we will have more on that in just a minute, because that is directed by Connor Allen Smith, who is today's guest, and features the music of Evelyn Landau, who you may remember from the recent episode on Disclosure. So that is very exciting. Congratulations to all those friends of the show. I'm excited that they're getting to screen their films at such a big festival this year. Aside from those, there are some big buzzy films playing the festival this year as well. Here's a few that caught my eye. First up is a film called Mogul Mowgli. This is a new film starring Riz Ahmed and directed by Bassam Tariq. Bassam Tariq is a name you'll probably be hearing more of because he is right now attached to direct the upcoming Blade movie for Marvel, so he'll probably be in the news a bit more down the road here. I've been hearing a lot of good things about Mogul Mowgli, and I'm really eager to see Riz Ahmed in anything again after he was so amazing in last year's Sound of Metal. I'm also hoping to catch up with a film called Coda, which is about a deaf family and their one hearing daughter, who is a singer. It took Sundance by storm this year. I've been hearing lots of good things about it, and that's playing this week as well. And finally, a film called Language Lessons. It first caught my eye because Mark Duplass is the co-writer. I'm a pretty big fan of most of the work of the Duplass brothers, but then I realized that the other writer and the director for this film is Natalie Morales. I recognize her mostly from Parks and Recreation. She played Lucy, but I'm really excited to see what she does behind the camera. There are lots of other films playing as well. In addition to films, there are some fascinating panels that are planned, including one that's going to kind of launch a research study on Asian and Pacific Islander representation in the media. I'm excited to check that one out. You can find that and more in the full list of films and panels at bentonvillefilm.org. I'm really excited for the Bentonville Festival. I'll be attending virtually this year. You can follow along my social media at Art House Garage on Instagram and Twitter, and I'll be posting about the things going on. And in more festival news, there's actually a new festival in Arkansas just a few days later on August 13th and 14th. This is the inaugural Fort Smith International Film Festival, presented by the River Valley Film Society. According to their website, quote, the Fort Smith International Film Festival is a two-day experience celebrating the artistic expression and diverse experiences of Native American and people of color through film, panel discussions, music, food, and more. I'm excited that this is happening because I grew up in Van Buren, just outside of Fort Smith, so this is my old stomping grounds. The festival is taking place in a handful of venues around the city, and there's also an Art House Garage alum featured. That's my old friend, Michael Ferris, who you may remember if you've listened to our episode on The Maltese Falcon. His film, The Rock of Gibraltar, is playing the festival, and interestingly, the film is partly an homage to classic noir films like The Maltese Falcon. Michael and I used to make home movies together back in high school, and now he's off showing his work at film festivals. That's pretty cool, and I'm so proud of him and his film. Go to fortsmithfilm.com to find all the details on the festival and how you can attend, and you can find links to those things in the show notes as well. All right, if you came here just for the Green Knight, sorry for all the festival talk, we're almost there. Let's introduce today's first guest. It's my friend and filmmaker Connor Allen Smith. Connor is a director, an actor, and he's the resident artist for Prairie Creek Productions. And he starred in one of my favorite films from last year's Filmland Festival. That's a short called Fletcher. He also directed a fascinating short called Phosphorescence that also played that festival. And he's back with a new short called Self-Portrait. We'll talk just a minute about his new film before we get into the main event, which is, of course, The Green Knight. Okay, The Green Knight. This is a big one. I've been waiting for this movie for a long time. It's been delayed and delayed by the pandemic, but it's finally here, playing in theaters. This is the latest film from director David Lowery, and it's a huge fantasy epic based on the classic story, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. I really enjoy medieval literature and Arthurian legends, so I suspected that this would be right up my alley. It stars Dev Patel, Alicia Vikander, Joel Edgerton, and many more, including Ralph Ineson, who has one of my favorite voices ever as the Green Knight himself. I'm so excited to dig into this movie, so here is my conversation with Connor Allen Smith. Welcome back to the podcast, Connor Allen Smith. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Yeah, happy to be here. I've been, it's been a minute, but I we got a festival going on and I've been really busy, but it's been one of the things that's getting me through all this busy period right now is I've been listening to old episodes of Art House Garage. So it's really exciting to be back here and again, getting to talk with you.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. When we talked about First Cow last time, that has remained one of my favorite episodes that I've done. So I thank you. And I'm so glad to have you back. And since that time, you connected me to Evelyn Landau, who came on to talk about Disclosure not so long ago. And that's actually a good transition because she has done some music for your latest short film, which I want to talk about, and the festival that's coming up with it. So that film is called Self-Portrait, which I have seen it, and it's very good. Tell us about the film and what's coming up as far as the festival run.
I think a quick sidebar on Evelyn. She's special. She's one of my favorite artists and a frequent collaborator of mine. So I'm excited y'all got to connect. And Self-Portrait is just another instance of us, me being lucky to work with her again. So she actually did the music for and did our stereo mix, so our initial sound soundscape for a Self-Portrait. With Self-Portrait, we're really excited. I'm excited to tell especially Arkansas folks that it's going to be premiering at Bentonville Film Festival next week, or this week, whenever this is dropping.
This is actually going to drop on the 2nd, so the first day the festival is the 2nd. Exactly. So yeah,
and it is live right now. Click that link in the bio. Go watch this movie and some other great regional stuff. Mm-hmm. I know you've also had, not to digress too much, but Sophie Lynn. I met her on the Q&A last week with Claire Barnett's film.
And Claire's wonderful too. But yeah, I've had Sophie on the podcast, and James Basham is also in that film. It's a short, but he's in it for a minute, and he's been on the podcast several times. So yeah, lots of Art House Garage folks in the Bentonville Film Festival this year, which is cool.
Exactly. Yeah. All those Art House Garage stands, come on out.
Yes.
whether you're in Northwest Arkansas or click that or watch them online, they're going to be accessible. Thank you, Gina. Yes. So we're premiering there for our world premiere, which is really exciting. Me and my partner are going to be driving down there. We have another creative partner who's currently still based in Fayetteville, Arkansas. So we're going to make a thing of it, just try to kiss some babies with COVID in mind and shake some hands, do all the fun stuff. But more than anything, kind of just get out of Chicago for a minute and be back home. So we're excited for that. And then as far as the project itself, you know, it's a very, it's a kind of in the title, a very personal project, and one that it's kind of odd to show people, for people to be excited, enthusiastic about it, and welcome it to a festival like BFF mm-hmm. is very humbling and also very odd. It's like, why is this interesting to people? But yeah, that's a little bit about it.
It's sort of a day in the life during quarantine, and it's it's kind of interesting because, I mean, it's such a weird cultural moment 18 months or whatever now that it's been, but that there's certain, you know, creative things that have sort of tried to capture the feeling of that. And like, I think about the Bo Burnham special Inside mm-hmm. from recently that was such a big creative funny thing, but this is very different than that, obviously, but much more serious in tone. And but I think it's doing a similar thing. At least there's something cathartic about realizing you're not alone in what you're going through in this weird time. So yeah, I think it's great for that reason.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, that was exactly what it was. Last year, I really struggled in a lot of ways figuring out, as I was kind of in the beginning of the starting this or transition into putting stuff out there creatively and thinking like, well, what do I do right now? What can I do right now? It feels like in a lot of ways I shouldn't be doing anything right now. But just processing through my own emotions, it was really the kind of it's cliche, which makes it kind of hurtful that it's true and still powerful to me. But it's like, well, a filmmaker makes a film. So sat down and put pen to paper and got my creative people and friends like Evelyn involved. And we put together this kind of really what was supposed to be a time capsule or a little Polaroid of what me and my partner were going through last year on a day to day basis, and try and focus in on the motion of it more than the exactness of it. And I think there's some seriousness to it, but I'm hoping that it's self-aware enough so it's not too dour, because we definitely had a very privileged perspective in our very nice but cramped apartment last year. We lived in a 500 square foot place and both worked from home and didn't go outside because we were in Chicago and there's just too many people. So yeah, it was a dynamic space with not a lot of capacity for entropy.
Well, I'm so excited for people to see it. That is playing at the Bentonville Film Festival. Details are in the show notes. You can go to bentonvillefilm.org for like schedule and all of that. But yeah, you can also watch it virtually, which I believe is on demand. Kind of you pay your ticket price and watch it this week at whatever point you want. So please check that out. I'm really excited that you are included and that your film is getting out there.
Oh, appreciate it. Yeah.
Well, I guess without further ado, let's get into the film we're here to talk about today, the big film, which is The Green Knight.
Friends. Brothers and sisters. Who can regale me and my queen with some myth? Or tale?
O greatest of kings, let one of your knights try to land a blow against me. Indulge me in this game.
I will need thee.
All right, let's talk about The Green Knight. This is the latest film from director David Lowery, and it stars Dev Patel, it stars Alicia Vikander, it stars Joel Edgerton, some other really great people. This is an Arthurian legend. It's the story of Sir Gawain, which the pronunciation of that is interesting. Maybe we could talk about that. There's different ways to maybe pronounce Gawain, and The Green Knight, the medieval story, Sir Gawain and The Green Knight. It's sort of a new adaptation of that, reimagination in some ways of that old story. And it is just a really epic big, large-scale fantasy movie, the likes of which I haven't seen in a while. And so I was excited. I've been excited for this for, I feel like, 2 years now or something, however long it's been delayed because of COVID. But it's also just been, I think, on the docket for a long time. So I'm glad it's finally here and that I've seen it, and I can't wait to kind of get into it. So Connor, before we talk about this movie, what's your relationship with David Lowery and his other films? Have you seen others of his movies?
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan. Ain't Them Body Saints, Old Man and the Gun, Pete's Dragon. Even it's that one's a little more saccharine and maudlin in some ways, but it's still really well made. Mm-hmm. Being from that Disney machine, but yeah, no, I like to say I'm a big fan, because whenever there is like a somewhat young, or like whether it's Jeff Nichols or other young filmmakers from the South that are a little ahead of me, they kind of take on this, like, I don't know, inspirational feat in a lot of ways. And David Lowery's a Dallas kid. I'm originally from Dallas, and I got a lot of family still in Dallas. So when I heard, I think it was the first ruckus I heard about him was about Ain't Them Body Saints. And so I watched that. It's Casey Affleck, and it's Mara Rooney, like kind of very Malickian, like kind of romance, and it really took my breath away. It's just it's a gorgeous film. So, really, since then, I've been a fan over this a decade now, which is odd to think about. That's been that long. But yeah, because he's still so young and feels so young. And I'm excited to see what he makes going forward. But yeah, so I'm a fan. I'm interested to know your relationship with him. Was this your first exposure to Lowery?
It was not. So actually, I think I had heard of him. I remember it was when A Ghost Story was coming out that I kind of was like, this what's this weird movie that's coming? And then the Arkansas Cinema Society showed A Ghost Story and Pete's Dragon, actually, and he was there for Q&A and stuff. So that was kind of my first exposure. Like, I've been wanting to see A Ghost Story, and then it turned out it was coming here to Little Rock for this event. So I got to watch that, and I mean, that film is so unique and odd and so moving. Quickly connected with it, and it's like I gotta own the copy of this. Like, this is one I need to have and like have around. But then I thought Pete's Dragon was really good too. Yeah, it's for what it is. And I think there's certain kids movies that don't respect attention spans, but this is not one of those. Like, this one, like, it's a little slower than a lot of kids movies, and it has some like serious emotion to it. It's like heavy in some ways that a lot of like family features aren't, but I think that's a good thing about it. But yeah, and then so after that I went back and watched Ain't Them Body Saints, and I always wanted to compare it to the assassination of Jesse James.
Oh, sure.
Just because it's kind of a similar time period, and we got Casey Affleck in there, but yeah, it's more of a romance, and I think that's well, you could also argue that Jesse James is a romance, but anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I think I think in that one, I really sense like he has a real sense of like just setting and set design and production design that you get in A Ghost Story, but it's very different when it's kind of a period piece like that. So I kind of felt that those were the strong suits there. And it's interesting that I learned this in Q&A like a couple years ago, but he started out as an editor. And I always try to think about like what a filmmaker did before they were a filmmaker, and whether that, before they were a director anyway, whether that kind of informs it, their movies. And so I think you could probably make an argument that The Green Knight is a very specifically edited movie, and that's probably to its credit. But then one other thing I want to mention, he also has a short film on Criterion Channel called Pioneer that is really good as well. It's just about 15 minutes. It's Will Oldham, and he's telling a story to his son, like a bedtime story, and it's really good. I really like it. And actually, there's a little connection I found to this movie we're going to talk about. But you know, Will Oldham is in A Ghost Story as well. And that,
yeah, is that was sequence. That the Rosetta Stone? I know he had written that monologue for A Ghost Story previously, before A Ghost Story even existed. Was that the source material, or is that?
I don't remember exactly, but I think it's different. I think, but it's. And this is kind of what I want to get to when we talk about Green Knight too, is kind of about the power of storytelling. And I think that's a cool thing about this movie too. So yeah, check that out. I'm going to shout that out as well. That's on Criterion Channel if you have access to that. It's a good one. So yeah, big fan of David Lowery. I'm excited to, and I think I saw like a tweet or something long ago that this was his next thing. He's going to do Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And I studied, I was an English major. I had a medieval literature class. And so I had read this story and I was like, wow, that's an interesting kind of thing to be your next project. And yeah, so maybe we can talk a little bit about the adaptation of it in a minute, but so yes, there was a lot of hype for this movie after being delayed, all of that. Did this one live up to your expectations?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, I mean, you had really apt kind of descriptors of his work earlier, but I think the things that stood out to me initially, or not, like what I've been a big fan of David Lowery over the years has been his world building, because even though a lot of his stuff takes place in somewhere close to reality, it's definitely not... It's definitely not. And often it's not a reality. It's not even like the normal like cinema or Hollywood reality. It's it is something off the beaten path, which I've always appreciated. And then the other thing that really stood out to me with his work is his sense. And I think this becomes because he was an editor, is a sense of duration. Mm-hmm. He has a real patience that I think a lot of us can learn from as young filmmakers or as filmmakers. And it's just kind of, in a lot of ways, drifting against the stream, where you know so much of content's getting shorter form and more cuts and faster, trying to keep attention spans. Mm-hmm. I think there's a really valid counter movement, which is just say, no, that's just when you do things like that, that's another format. And what's great about big movies on a big screen is when you have an audience sit down with a big image for a long time and you don't give them the escape of a particular cut. And I think all those things, or both those attributes, were really on display in Green Knight. There are some really wonderful long takes in this film that really are put you in the mindset of Sir Gawain as he's on this kind of interior really it's like a psychological journey. So it does a great job of empathizing you with that character's mindset, but also. In addition, the world itself, I mean, you just look around, every single inch you talked about set decoration is decorated to a T. It's so thorough. From the green belt he wears to the crown, the flaming crown, everything's gorgeous.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, completely agree. Yeah, the world building is, that's a good way to put it. Because even like in a ghost story, like it's pretty small, like contained sets, but the world is so big where that movie goes is so surprising and so big. And yeah, doing that with seemingly little, you know, and I think, yeah, this movie does that wonderfully. And that's probably, if I had to just say like the one thing that sticks out about this movie is just the world and being able to like live in this medieval setting. And it can feel so lived in and that has to do with the cinematography and like you're talking about the duration of shots, has to do with the production design, the costumes, even the score and like all the structure of the story. It you feel like you're kind of living in this time for a couple hours. And I really, really liked that about it. Yes, this did live up to the hype for me I knew what to expect on some level, but at the same time, I had no idea what to expect because it's like, where are we going to go with this? And I knew, so the story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, like the medieval story, there's not that much there. I was like, so how are we going to make this into a 2-hour story? I know they're going to add something, but I didn't expect it to so it's kind of broken up into little vignettes almost with title cards and like little mini stories along the way, along the quest. It reminded me of like the Odyssey or something. But it also, I did a little research and someone can maybe correct me on this, but a lot of the stories in the middle, I looked to see if there's source material, if those are from actual medieval stories, and I couldn't find anything that matched up quite right. Like as far as, I mean, I just clicked around Wikipedia for a while, so it wasn't that in depth, but, so I don't know if some of those were created for this film or what, but the actual Green Knight story that more or less bookends the film is pretty faithful to the source, but it has some notable changes, some adaptations, and that I think work really well in this movie. So yeah, go ahead.
No, yeah. I think, that was something that I tried to release myself because I did not have a relationship with this story, or this tale, really. Cause I studied classics a little bit, but most of my, at the University of Arkansas, but most of that was, Greek and Roman stuff. Mm-hmm. And so as far as when it comes to medieval times, really the only stuff I've read from that, it would be like St. Augustine, and some philosophy, but nothing like really, narrative or so whimsical.
Yeah.
And so I tried to just release my expectations of of whether things were staunchly adaptated or not, or even kind of maybe this is a peek inside how I watch movies. I try to kind of also just release my need to know, and so didn't just to kind of like feel the expression and the mood of it all. And I could unpack it and, you know, fact check it later, but definitely in the moment last night, because I was at the first screening I think they did in Chicago, at the Music Box, which is like one of our old art house theaters. It was really lovely, and one of the basically the fullest house I've been in since COVID, and it was it was amazing.
That's great.
But yeah, so it was a great way to like, and this is often used as, I feel like, derogatory, but it was just true escapism. It was like just sit down, turn the brain off in some ways, and like just feel this this very elemental story happening.
Yeah, I love that. And I think one of the things I wanted to mention about it is just there's kind of a sense of wonder that you don't always get in movies. Like, I think probably the last big like fantasy epic that I really have seen is Lord of the Rings, and there's probably a lot of viewers are going to go into this expecting something more like that, but this is not that. And like we talked about with those long cuts and the patience that he gives, like there's not an action scene every 10 minutes, and it's just a very different kind of film than that. I think the audience I was with maybe wanted Lord of the Rings. I could talk about that later, but they weren't a great audience. But here in Little Rock, I really connected with it for that reason. Like you don't really know where it's going to go. I think that's some of the fun of it, and some of the things that happen along the way are really surprising. But
yeah, well, you said a word there a second ago that really resonated with me, which is like the imagination aspect of it, because I feel like. And maybe this is because maybe this is not what all audiences want to, or mainstream audiences want, but it's not for me to decide, or or smarter people will make that decision. But as far as, you know, I feel like so much just my armchair analysis is so much of filmmaking these days, or especially bigger filmmaking, is so unimaginative, and not that it's uncreative, but it's just so based in realism, or making Iron Man look like the physics look exactly how it's supposed to look.
Yeah.
Where this like really does not care about whether it's sticking to the story or have the physics of everything. It's constantly playing with mood and with things that cause an emotional and kind of spiritual reaction that I think that it's paying way more attention to the through line of those things than the reality of it all, which I think is what we're hungry for. Or at least I'm hungry for.
I love that. You said the word spiritual, and that always sets me off in a good way. that's one of my words. Thank you. Yeah. But I think that's absolutely a part of this. You know, it's, we talked to my previous episode with my friend Omaya. We're doing Wong Kar Wai, the Wong Kar Wai Criterion box set. We're talking about Days of Being Wild, and we kind of just touched on the whole vibes conversation, which is a kind of a weird thing that's happening in like film Twitter and stuff right now. Basically, to sum it up in maybe a not great way, is there's certain movies that you might watch for plot and others that you might watch for like mood and tone and quote unquote vibes, and it can be both, right? I don't think it has to be either or, but I think this movie definitely sets the tone in a mood, and like if you want to go and have a vibe, this is a great movie for you. Yeah, because it is slower, and again, it's not super action-packed that like you might think about a medieval story, but it really gives you time to kind of live in that world and experience it. Was there anything as far as like thematic material that stuck out to you with this movie?
Yeah, I mean, growing up in, you know, the Bible Belt and in Arkansas, you know, this whole idea of chastity and honor are all things that feel, and obviously just there's religious themes throughout the whole thing. I mean, in the opening moments, Sir Gawain is lying about going to mass. So a lot of this felt very contemporary and very relatable in a lot of ways. You really see this amazingly acted Dev Patel performance and character. Just being one of the most relatable things I've seen in a minute, because he is just so he's so green. I was trying to avoid the pun.
There you go. I like it.
But yeah, but it was just so so nice, and I mean and so relatable. But yeah, as far as like specific themes, I think those are the two biggest things. It's just the idea of honor and how do we as a society, especially as we like are starting to reconcile with these things that are irrecoverable horrors that we've done to each other and done to specific groups of people. But how can we move forward, or how do we is there a way to move forward? And is there a code that we can develop, that we can have this sense of common manners about us? Or is it all just chaos? You know?
Wow. That's really interesting to think about. Yeah, because in this time period, especially, like, people live by a code, and like, especially the knights, like, they want to be chivalrous. They want to, you know, have honor and nobility. And that's absolutely a big part of it. And that kind of is connected to just one of the things that I really liked about it is sort of the theme about, you know, facing death and the inevitability of death, and how, I mean, that drives so many stories. And like, I actually just thought about the seventh seal just from him like walking through the forest and like and approaching death potentially, you know. Like, I don't know if that was an intentional like connection point, but that was definitely on my mind. But then it also connects to a ghost story, because, you know, so much of that movie is about facing death and like how does death affect us as people. So I thought that was a cool way, and that really plays out in the ending in ways that I won't spoil, but I thought that was really good. And that's kind of, I think, what the original text is about, is you know, doing something honorable in the face of death, like kind of the basic idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The other thing that I really connected with a lot was the storytelling kind of aspect of it, and kind of how we as humans make stories out of things and make legends. And the movie really kind of plays with that idea. So right at the bat, we have, you know, images of King Arthur and Lady Guinevere, like paintings and portraits of them, and just kind of hinting at like, and then that the kind of the real life context of, was King Arthur a real person? Historians don't really know. He may only exist in literature. So we have these images that people, even like contemporary, like at this time, we're connecting with these heroic figures, and Gawain wants to be one of those. He wants to be legendary. And there's talk about, I want to be a legend, I want to achieve greatness. One of my favorite lines is when his lover in the beginning of the film says something like, greatness, why is goodness not enough? And it's like that kind of idea of like, he's striving for this, and why, you know? But then we see the story told, like, so we watch it play out, which it's mostly in the trailer, if you've seen, and this, the kind of the premise is that this green knight shows up, says, if anyone can land a blow on me, then 1 year later, you come to me and I'm going to do the same to you. And like, that's kind of the structure. And apparently that was a pretty common thing in medieval literature, like a game of blows or something like that. So Gawain beheads the Green Knight, and then a year later is supposed to, you know, go to the Green Chapel and face the same fate. But the Green Knight, of course, just picks his own head up and talks to them and rides out. And it's like, this is really interesting. But so we see that play out in a puppet show. They're like they're singing songs about him in the bar. At one point, the people are telling his story, like, you're the guy from the story. And so like, people have created the story around him. And the story also changes and kind of grows and takes on its own meaning. Like, we hear it from the barman, and some of the details are not exactly right. Like, he used the sword or he used the axe, and like the story changes and kind of becomes its own thing. And so that, that kind of idea, sorry, this is my, I have a lot of notes on this. I'm just going to keep rolling.
No, go for it. This is great. Yeah.
He runs into a guy on the battlefield later, and there's of course all these dead bodies around, but, the guy he is talking to says, you know, they say the king killed 960 men all on his own. And so we see again, like, kind of the myth making and the legend making about King Arthur there. And so one of the things I really like about it too is that we see those people's reactions. So like, this is a story that he's, you know, probably fabricated or somehow has heard, but it's a story that's like lighting his fire. Like he finds hope or finds meaning somehow in this story. Mm-hmm. And the same thing when we see the puppet show, we see the thrills, and there's close-ups of the faces of the young people watching this, and like they're thrilled by it, but they also like seem to find some hope in like this heroic story. And I think that kind of then can carry on to us as the audience for this film, because it's like, this is kind of what you were saying, it's kind of grounded in reality, but all these fantastical things are happening in it.
And it's kind of a way of saying, like, these stories have value for us too. And maybe that's one of the things that makes us human, is that we kind of love stories. We make stories out of nothing sometimes and find meaning in that. And that's kind of part of the human experience. And kind of going back to my medieval literature class, we also studied hagiography, which is the study of saints and, like, saint stories. And some of these saint stories are wild. Like, so I remember learning what these stories were. I was like, okay, these are, like, things that would have been told in church, like in the Catholic Church. These are Catholic saints. But then you hear some of the stories and they're absolutely wild. And it's like, do people think this was true, or did they not care if it was true? It was just, and it made me think, like, Greek mythology had things that seem unbelievable to us now, yet those stories brought people meaning. And so in hagiography, you have, like, people fighting dragons and all kinds of stuff. And it's like, this is a saint for Christ. There's all kinds of interesting stuff in there, but I think, again, points to this kind of meaning making and story making. And so that also is kind of saying, like, was King Arthur a real person? It doesn't really matter. Like, these stories have meaning on their own. So anyway, I really like all of that.
No, I mean, there's a lot to chew on what you just said. Yeah. And I feel like it's what you're talking about. It's through the ages we've seen over and over. And I think we are all immediately familiar with it. And we don't need to digress too much, but we're all very familiar with people not wanting to believe in basic truths that are proven in our current climate, or things that, like, we have scientific record for, or, you know, there are certain lies out there that it's just more exciting to believe in the myths. And it doesn't matter if it's grounded in reality or if it's grounded in science or a lot of things. If someone is more attractive or more exciting to people, they're going to want to believe it. And humans have proved that, over and over for millennia. And it's kind of what's terrifying about us, but also kind of is also aspirational of us. When we look at the glass half full, I think we can see people who really want to believe in greatness and want to support other people. again, really trying to be maybe even naive when I say that, but I think there's a lot of weight and a lot of there's a lot of hope that I think is in all of us, and that we try to utilize, but often gets misplaced. And it's that weight of other people's hope is often debilitating. And we see that, I think, with Sir Gawain in the story. We see that over and over in history, where people, you referenced the assassination of Jesse James earlier, that the whole myth making behind that character ruined him. The way legends spread is a thing that we see over and over in storytelling and in history.
Yes. And I just love the movie kind of deals with that. And this movie I really have to watch again because it's pretty complex. And I need to revisit, like, what exactly was going on with his mother at the beginning, and, like, what role does she play in all of this? So Sir Gawain is King Arthur's nephew, we should mention. And that's from the original story, too. There's a lot of those things, and Joel Edgerton's character is really interesting, and kind of what plays out there is there's some surprises, actually. So I won't spoil it, but I'll kind of hint at it, so if people have seen it, there's, like, a surprising moment that they have in the woods near the end of the film, Sir Gawain and Joel Edgerton, and that was something that made the audience I was with and here in North Little Rock kind of giggle. And that I was, like, surprised by that too, but then I was looking back at the story, that's actually in the original text too, and actually more of it, so there's some interesting readings of that original story too. I think I like that a lot. I think this movie is really well plotted. Like, I really love the story with Saint Winifred. He goes to this house in the middle of the wilderness, kind of, and meets this woman there, and kind of what plays out there is really cool. If you've seen the trailer, you know there's giants in this movie. The giant scene I loved. I thought that may be my favorite part of the whole movie, and kind of getting at that, like, sense of wonder and spirituality potentially that you mentioned. Like, I don't know, just there's, it kind of pointed for me to the connectedness of things without spoiling exactly what happens. I mean, it's a really short scene, but there's sort of the presence of nature in this movie is interesting, and sort of the way it's, I don't know, kind of pointed to a connectedness, general sense of connectedness for me is how I read it. But anyway, I'm a big fan of this movie. I know there are more things to say. Do you have other kind of things you want to say about this movie before we
No, I think you did a great job in all the best in your monologue. I think this is I'd highly recommend this film. I think it's going to make some people uncomfortable, but I think I challenge them to sit through it and really sit through the meditation. Yeah, I think it's just really profound, and I think in the patience it has and the questions it's asking. Yeah, and even just hearing somebody else talk about it, you know, I'm stoked, because I watched this 10 hours ago. So I'm still definitely unpacking it myself, and like listening to things you unpacked immediately, it's all been great. And I think we need more movies like this that are really, really sticking with folks and sticking to people's craws, that that you can't not talk about, that you can't not think about for a while.
Yeah, I think the complexity of it really lends itself to like lots of different readings too, which is not necessarily that common with like a big studio movie. So I think that's a cool thing about it too. And yeah, like the meditative aspect of it, absolutely, that's there in A Ghost Story as well. So I think that's a cool kind of through line as well. Well, yes, that is The Green Knight, directed by David Lowery. It's from A24. It's in theaters now. We both highly recommend it, it sounds like.
Yeah, three thumbs way up.
Three thumbs. All right. Well, thank you so much, Connor, for joining the show again. And I will link to all the Bentonville Film Festival stuff. Go and see Self Portrait or watch it at home if you can. And thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Yeah. And I'll also say this. If you're out there at the festival, we're doing our screening. The regional showcase is Tuesday at 11. Let's come shake hands if you're comfortable with that. I know there's going to be some other filmmakers that I'm sure would be happy to meet you. We'd love to have you there in person and love to say hi and connect with just other great movie fans from Arkansas. The Arkansas film scene's growing, and the film community audiences are integral to that growing. So let's shorten that gap if we can. But yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And connecting in person it's like weird that we can do that again. So yeah, it when you can safely. I love it. Well, cool. Well, thank you so much. And we will have you back hopefully soon for something else.
I'm hoping.
All right. Thanks, Connor.
All right.
Huge thanks to Connor for being on the show, and congrats again on your film Self-Portrait. After I listened back to our talk on The Green Knight, I realized that there were so many things I didn't mention. We didn't talk about King Arthur at all. I forgot to mention the incredible score by Daniel Hart. We barely talked about The Fox or about Dev Patel's wonderful performance in this. That's okay. It's a big movie. There's only so much we had time for. I'm obviously a huge fan of this movie, and I highly encourage you to seek it out. And now we move from medieval England to 1960s Hong Kong as we continue our series on the world of Wong Kar-wai. Omaya Jones is back, and today we're looking at the second film in the Criterion box set, Days of Being Wild. Spoiler alert, I really like this movie too. We talk all about the film, its stars, its production, and some of the signature Wong Kar-wai touches you can find in it. Omaya Jones has been on the show many times, and he's joining us for this whole series. He's a film podcaster, and he's had a part in lots of film things in the area, like programming the Arkansas Time film series back before the pandemic. Welcome back again, Omaya Jones. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. And thanks again for being back for this. It's our second of the six episodes we're going to do on Wong Kar-wai. And I'm excited to get into it. But before we do, how have you been, and what have you been watching lately? Anything else besides Wong Kar-wai?
Yeah, I've been doing pretty good. In addition to Wong Kar-wai, I've been watching, I told you before, I've been watching NYPD Blue because I have, a sense of nostalgia. But I also watched a film that I think thematically links pretty well with the film that we're talking about tonight. And that Saturday Night Fever, which I'd never seen before and had been on my list for a long time.
Nice.
And then I got interested again, I think last year when that Bee Gees documentary came out, or maybe it was earlier this year, because I don't know how time works anymore. But but yeah, like there's the way that the men and women negotiate their relationships with each other that I think there's some resonance with, specifically the toxic nature of the way the men treat the women.
I haven't seen that movie since college, but I was surprised. I was like, oh, it's this dancing movie. I didn't know it had quite so much, you know, dramatic teeth to it. I don't remember much about it, but
it gets dark. It gets really dark. But yeah. then the dancing scenes are fantastic because, you know, it's almost like an art film or something, because it's like the dialogue fades away and it's just these extended sequences of John Travolta on the dance floor. And it's magnificent.
Mesmerizing.
Yeah.
yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, I want to mention one thing, and that is the movie Pig, the new movie with Nicolas Cage. I like this movie a lot. I didn't know much about it going in. I kind of heard a few little rumblings, but it seemed like a movie I shouldn't know much about going in, and that's true, so I won't say too much. But it's directed by Michael Sarnowski, and Nicolas Cage is a truffle hunter, I guess is the word. Truffle hunter, and he has a pig that sniffs out the truffles. But it goes in a lot of surprising directions. The tweet I sent out is like, it's a weird combination of John Wick and Babette's Feast. Like, it has a lot of both of those movies, which is, I never expected those two things to come together in one movie. But that's a pretty accurate, and it's good. It's really good. Nicolas Cage is being praised a lot for his performance. I think it is a really good performance. I don't think it's going to be like award worthy or anything like that, but I think it's really, really good. I've been seeing some people say that, and I'm like, I don't know about that, but I do think it's good, and it's just not quite what we're used to from him sometimes. It's a lot more subdued, and it's solid. And then it's Alex Wolff is the other kind of co-lead in it, and he's from Hereditary and several other things, and he's really good too. So yeah, I'll recommend Pig. Go in as blind as you can with it, not knowing much, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Awesome. I have not seen it, but by the time this is uploaded, I will have seen it. So I'm planning on going tomorrow night.
Nice. Yes, yes. Yeah, I was playing down at the Rave is where I went and saw it. But well, cool. I guess from there, let's talk about Days of Being Wild. So, kind of basic facts about this movie. It came out in 1990. It stars Leslie Cheung, who we'll see again later in some other, at least one other of these films. Maggie Cheung, who we'll also see again, and we already saw in As Tears Go By. Andy Lau, same for him. He was in As Tears Go By. Karina Lau, Rebecca Pan, Jackie Cheung, and there's also a brief appearance by Tony Leung. And we'll talk about his very odd little scene right at the end of this movie a little later. But so some people we've seen before, and some people that, you know, are kind of regular Wong Kar Wai players, it seems like. I always like looking up the translations of the title. So with As Tears Go By, it was a drastically different title from Chinese to English. They just like gave it an American or an English title. But this one is basically the same. The Chinese translates to True Story of a Hooligan, which I kind of like that little twist on Days of Being Wild. I think other notable things as far as the people involved is the cinematographer, Christopher Doyle. This was their first partnership, or at least the first movie they worked on together, and he goes on to do, I don't know, six more films with him, I think. So they collaborate a lot going forward. And I think the cinematography is very, very good in this. So that's kind of a notable thing about it. But yeah. So let me ask you this one, Maya. How many times have you seen this now?
This was my third time seeing this film. Okay.
This was my first. And yeah, so I guess kind of broad strokes of the plot. We won't talk too much detail about the ending. I think we can kind of like, I'm not really much that you can spoil, I guess. There's a little bit, but anyway, it stars Leslie Cheung. He plays Yeti, and he's kind of a playboy, kind of drifting through life. The essay in the Criterion box, the John Powers essay, refers to him sort of a rebel without a cause, and that seems to fit, I think, pretty well. He treats women very poorly, but he's very good at seducing them, and then he treats them badly. He also treats his mother poorly. We find out this is his adoptive mother. And he's also very curious to meet his birth mother. That's kind of the one thing he seems to really care about in life. But his adoptive mother, Rebecca, has been denying him this for a long time. We first, like, the opening of the movie is Yeti seducing Maggie Cheung's character, who is named Lai Jin, and she works at a soccer stadium. She's kind of in this concession stand alone, and the opening sequence is him repeatedly going there and kind of flirting with her. So they get together, and then she wants to get serious, and he breaks up with her. He's very kind of cruel to her. She's very distraught by this. That kind of comes back into the story. He then goes and dates Mimi, who's a dancer, and he has a best friend named Zeb, who is also in love with Mimi, has feelings for Mimi. So that's kind of the next relationship that grows there. Meanwhile, Lai Jin, who he's broken her heart, she is very distraught. She befriends Andy Lau's character, whose name is Tide. He's a policeman, and they have some scenes together. And then the final third or so is Yeti, and he's seeking his birth mother, and kind of the things that happen directly after that. So that's kind of broad strokes. It's kind of all over the place, and I think that may be something that I need to get used to with movies like this, that there's a lot of threads kind of going in different directions. Again, this is, I feel like I'm the relative newbie to Wong Kar-wai, but I did sense that there's some of his signature things happening in this movie. And I think you said last time, Amaya, that like this is the first one that, like, okay, this feels like a Wong Kar-wai movie. So what do you think as far as sort of signature Wong Kar-wai touches that are here in this movie?
Yeah, I would say the unconventional narrative structure for sure, right? Mm-hmm. And then you can sort of see the way that it unfolds, that it wasn't exactly scripted there. I think there's a lot of improvisation. And there's a lot of letting the actors sort of figure out what the characters are or changing things on the fly, which is something, you know, we'll talk about later when we talk about the Tony Leung end scene and sort of some of the things that's going on there. But also, so my understanding is that Wong Kar-wai and Christopher Doyle both sort of have a background of really appreciating, I think, like South American literature. And so a lot of the narrative things that they take are from that. And so they're not beholden to like a conventional three-act structure. And so you can have this thing where you spend long stretches of time with one character that maybe has a tangential relationship to another. And then somehow everything sort of wraps around in the end. And so like in this case, two characters that have no relationship with each other really end up meeting in a different situation. It's just that freedom to do things differently and not be beholden to convention.
Yeah. Yeah, on that note about the narrative structure, yeah, I think last time you mentioned something about timeline sometimes jumps around a little bit in some of his movies. And so I did notice there are a couple of moments where it seems like we jump out of time or something happens out of order. And one of those is the opening credits. We see the shot of these trees going by and this kind of music playing that's kind of memorable. And we don't really understand where we are with that until the very end of the movie. They're on a train in the Philippines and we see the same shot of them looking at the trees. So that was, you know, kind of comes full circle with that. And then there's also a really interesting shot of his adopted mother, when she's talking about she wants to go off to the United States with her lover. And he's saying he doesn't want her to do that and he's going to stop her unless she tells him who his birth mother is. And there's a shot where it's suddenly like very different environment. It seems like maybe she's on a boat or something. It's hard to tell. But I imagine this is like her on her way traveling to the United States. And it's just like coming up on her back and she turns around and looks like right at the camera. So I didn't know if this was foreshadowing that she is going to be able to make this trip or if we're in his head, this is somehow something he's imagining or something she's imagining. It's not quite clear, but it was an interesting way to kind of just jump out of that scene with a little interesting kind of jump in the timeline, I think.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the social media conversation around vibes?
Yes. to some degree.
I just this is the kind of film that I think about. Like, if you say like a film was just vibes, I think it's something like this, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. So I had coffee with a friend recently who was talking about, he didn't use the word vibes, but I think he probably would be an appreciator of that sort of thing. Like people who like, think about like Nicholas Winding Refn with The Drive or Neon Demon, where there's so much like, whether it's like lighting and music happening, and we're kind of getting the vibes. Yeah. And it's more about the experience of like, how does this movie make you feel, than it is about like the plot. And I definitely have had that sort of thing on my mind, with As Tears Go By, that sequence with, Take My Breath Away. Like I've gone back and watched that a couple times just because it's such a vibe. It's such a mood piece. And it's really interesting. And like the lighting comes into that and the music and all of that. So yeah, that's a moment for sure when we see his adoptive mother in that scene, in that shot, that it suddenly kind of changes the vibe a little bit, but it's definitely like a visually striking moment, I think.
Absolutely. I had that with the end of the film, just the music that plays, and you just see characters doing thing with, but there's no dialogue or anything in particular happening. I could just watch that kind of stuff for hours.
Yeah. And I think it's almost a different way of like thinking about a movie or experiencing a movie, but this might be a good way to do that. To kind of introduce yourself to that. Like, okay, the plot is a little less important here, but like kind of try to get lost in this and how does it make you feel? I think that's kind of a cool little movie watching experiment, but, more things about like time and memory, because I know that's something that he deals with a lot. There's a lot of ticking clocks at different moments. It seems like there's just like a lot of kind of downtime too. Like in Lijin's job at the soccer stadium, she's just alone all the time. It feels like, until Yeti shows up and kind of tries to seduce her. Also, Yeti seems to maybe not have a job. It's not clear, but he, it's just kind of around and kind of drifting through his life. And I think there was something in one of the interviews on the disc that talked about like, that's one reason to set this in the 60s is because there were people who kind of lived that way, more than in the 80s and 90s when he was actually making these movies. But I thought it was interesting. They just have a lot of time on their hands. But then there's kind of a laziness, or just like the pace is slow and deliberate, I think. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. There's also,
yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say absolutely. I was concurring.
Yeah. There's also talk about like the relative feeling of time. They talk about the length of a minute, and how a minute can seem so long sometimes. So that was interesting, kind of looking at time as a construct, maybe kind of hinting at that, which is an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. Outside of the time stuff, I thought a lot about the longing and kind of sensuality of it. That's definitely present here. There's kind of a romanticism just in the setting, and maybe this kind of gets at the vibes thing too. But there's like a scene where Lai Jin and Tide, Andy Lau's character, she's, you know, very distraught, and they walk around the city. He's a policeman, and he's kind of patrolling, and they walk around and kind of talk about life and love, and it's this kind of like special relationship. It's not clear if it's romantic exactly, or would it be if they had more time together. Doesn't really address that, but I was thinking about like these empty streets in another movie, in a Hong Kong crime movie, which people expected this to be. We'll talk a little bit about kind of the reception to it. Empty city streets at night could feel really menacing or dangerous, but in this they feel kind of like romanticized and serendipitous, almost like just there's almost a longing just in the setting. That was really interesting. I just kind of had that. Yeah. And then at the end, it returns to those shots too. So like they walk around the city, and then at the end, it shows shots of these same places they walked, now empty, and kind of hinting back at that. It actually reminded me a lot of the end of Before Sunrise, the Richard Linklater movie, where they've walked around the city and having this romantic conversation this whole movie, and then the camera just goes back to the places they were. Now just life is happening, and it just kind of gives you this interesting feeling about something really special happened here, and and kind of the importance of locations and that kind of thing. But anyway,
I love that, because one thing that I find myself thinking about often is just the way in which places have a history that we are not aware of, one that we're not a part of. It's just interesting to think about all of the things that have happened in the places that we inhabit that we have no idea what perspired there.
Yeah.
Also, just thinking about how the film is like a long misconnection.
Yes, I was going to talk about that too. Go ahead, though.
Oh yeah. yeah, just like it's when Andy Lau's character and Maggie Cheung's character are talking, and he says the thing about to call him, and she never does. But there's like at one point, there's a phone booth in the area of the town that they're walking around in, and so at one point it rings. We don't know if it's her on the other end of the line or not, but it's just this idea that like if it weren't for a difference of a couple of days or a week or whatever, maybe things could have ended up differently.
Yeah, there's a ton of misconnections here in this movie. There's a lot of loves that go unfulfilled. So there's Yeti and Lai Jin, who he obviously breaks her heart. And then there's him and Mimi, who's the dancer. And they have a lot of fights as well. And then he ends up, you know, just kind of leaving town without telling her. And then there's Zeb, his friend, his guy friend, who's also enamored with Mimi, and that plays into it, but none of those things ever play out. And actually the Yeti and Mimi relationship is similar to the As Tears Go By relationship between those two, and that it's they're waiting for each other in a sense, and that things happen that keep them apart. Then there's his adopted mother. One of the first things we see is Yeti beating this man up. We find out it's the man who's courting or wants to marry his adoptive mother, and he kind of ruins that. So there's that relationship that doesn't happen. And then there's what you were just talking about with Lai Jin, Maggie Cheung's character, and Andy Lau's character, which, yeah, that seems like there's a longing there that doesn't come to fruition exactly. And then, of course, there's the relationship with Yeti and his birth mother, who that's actually one of my favorite scenes I was going to mention. I guess it really matters to spoil this. He does find out where his birth mother is, and it's a really brief moment in the movie, but obviously a big deal for him. But there's a shot inside this house, and it's interesting too, because Rebecca, his adoptive mother, has said, kind of, fine, I'll tell you, but you know, she's not rich. They didn't want you, blah, blah, blah. And she's kind of cruel about it. It looks like his birth mother is actually really wealthy. We just get a few shots inside her house, and then we see her peeking out the window as he's leaving, because they deny him access to the house. And then in the voiceover, he's walking away in slow motion, and he says, all I really wanted was to see her, and since I can't, I'm going to deny her that too. I know she's watching me now, and I'm going to deny that. So that was like an emotional moment, and also just like a big deal for his character. And then the shot is just really kind of arresting as he's kind of walking away, and we're hearing him say these things. So yes, a big misconnection there, that, you know, something that we're longing, and maybe that's all the longing in all his movies. Maybe it's just like we want these things to happen, and they don't for one reason or another, and that's just built into the plot in a way. But yeah, that's definitely a lot of misconnection moments. Do you have any other kind of signature Wong Kar-wai things? I have one more kind of thing to talk about with that, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if this happens in other movies, but here we have characters sort of acting as their own omnipotent narrator.
Yeah.
So, like in the scene that you just mentioned, it's as though he knows that his mother is watching. But how would he know that? And I guess it's because he is the author of his story to some extent, and he is able to dictate that. And then on the other thing is, what I think you're getting at is that like the most dramatic moments are avoided. Right. So like, and I feel like if this were like a Hollywood film or something, there would be a confrontation or a meeting between Yeti and his mother, or there would be a connection between Maggie Cheung's character and Andy Lau tied. But here, all of that is avoided, and it creates a more subtle drama that I also think is more interesting and more enriching, and it rewards it rewards the viewer for being able to sort of sit there and contemplate,
yeah,
and live in the world.
Hmm. Yeah, and it's more traumatic in a way too. You may think you could do a really interesting like psychological breakdown of the character of Yeti, but yeah, like even if they had met and had gone poorly, in a way that would have given closure or something, but it doesn't even get that. Like there's no connection at all, and that's almost harder in a way and more tragic. Yeah, I wanted to mention also, and this is something. So I've seen Chungking Express before a while ago, but so thinking on that one, and also As Tears Go By in this, there's just kind of a sensuality to this filmmaking that. So like, I think Christopher Doyle's cinematography is amazing, and it's like it's a beautiful movie in general, and like the lighting is really good and all of that. But then there's a lot of like awareness of bodies, and I mean that in intimate scenes. There's some very memorable, like kind of really sexy moments in this too. But even outside of that, there's dancing. That some of my favorite moments here are when his friend Zeb is talking to Mimi in the lobby of his building, and he asks her what she does, and she just goes into this little dance, and it's really like kind of cute and just an interesting kind of character moment. His reaction to it all is really interesting too. But then, so there's that dancing, there's some other dancing moments near the end. They are going to this in the train station. He dances a little bit, but there's another moment where he's dancing all by himself in the mirror, and some music is on the radio. And I just think it was a really cool little character moment. And yeah, there's just kind of an awareness of bodies there and skin. There's a lot of like shoulders and necks and clavicles and like close-ups of faces, and I think that's, I don't know, just like in As Tears Go By, the actors here are really beautiful, and this film kind of appreciates their beauty. And I don't mean that in just like a sexiness way. Like even like Zeb, again, I keep mentioning him, this minor character, the camera loves him and like looks at his face, and we get close-ups of him reacting to things. And I don't know, just it really you feel like you get to know these people because we see their faces, and we I don't know, we see their physicality a lot. So
yeah, I think so. I know Christopher Doyle has talked about the thing that interests him most in a project is not the script or the story necessarily, but the people and the people that he's working with and he's collaborating with. I was listening to a Q&A that he did, and someone asked him how he picks scripts of what he wants to shoot. And he said he doesn't read scripts. It's all about the crew. It's all about the actors and people that he's going to be working with. And so that's sort of his approach. And also just like, if you look at any other, the supplemental features with him, he's obviously loves life. He seems like the kind of guy who listens to the fullest. We haven't really talked about Christopher Doyle a lot, but he's Australian. He worked a number of jobs before he became a cinematographer. Like he worked on an oil rig. He worked as a sheep farmer or a cattle farmer or something. And then kind of fell into this, and it's all about love of photographing people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just sort of like the basis of his approach is the relationships with people.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's cool. I'm not that familiar with him. I'm actually going to click on his IMDb and see if I've seen anything else.
Did you see the Psycho remake with Gus Van Sant?
I have not seen it, but
he shot Paranoid Paranoid Park. Did you go to the ACS screening of that?
No, I did not.
Okay. That was I saw Paranoid Park when the ACS screened it as part of their Mark Thiedemann thing, and so he shot that. He also shot Hero.
Okay, yeah, I'm aware of that one. I haven't seen it.
And Lady in the Water. Those are the ones that I noted.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. Well, yes, I'm definitely going to check out some more of his work because, yeah, it feels very kind of humanistic or something. Yeah, like you're talking about just liking photographing people. Let's see, I had a few other just kind of things from this I really liked. I was going to mention the voiceover as well, like you did. And so there's that moment with Yeti as he's leaving his birth mother's house. There's also, I think this happened a little bit in As Tears Go By, and I want to say it happens in Chungking Express. I guess we'll find out next time. But it does kind of jump from character to character. There's a little bit of Maggie Cheung at one moment. I think she's talking about like how she feels about, I think it's about how Yeti's hitting on her or something. But then one that I really like was Andy Lau's character, Tide. he, and this serves a narrative function too, but he talks about his mother, who is on kind of on her deathbed, and she wanted him to be a policeman, or he became a policeman so he could stay close to her, but he really wanted to be a sailor. And in this voiceover, like right after he has this night of talking with Maggie Chung, he reveals that she does die pretty soon after this point, and that he then goes on and becomes a sailor. And then later we see him in his career as a sailor, which is, I didn't expect him to come back actually. And the fact that he did was interesting. But, so I like that about it. One of my favorite shots, I think, and actually Christopher Doyle, so I maybe should have run this down before, but kind of the other supplements that are on the Criterion disc, there's a trailer and then there's an alternate cut, which we'll talk about. There's an interview with Christopher Doyle and an interview with Maggie Chung. And in the Christopher Doyle one, he talks about this shot as well. It goes from there in the Philippines, and they're at this train station. And the camera starts out in the street and goes up the stairs, and we see like people in the street and what they're doing, and then all the way up into this little restaurant inside of the train station. And it's just kind of a really cool long shot. And he says in this interview that was his first Steadicam shot that he ever did. I thought it was pretty cool, little insight. And it's a really cool moment.
Yeah. That's a nice bit of choreography. And it also feels like it wasn't, you know, sometimes if you're watching some Hollywood films, there's like competition and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to do like a 10 minute single take.
Yeah.
The Steadicam, because so-and-so did one that was 8 minutes. You want to beat it.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I like, you know, like the way when the camera starts out, there's a guy who's sort of like harassing a homeless guy or something. And then it goes up the stairs, and then Yeti's dancing. And then there's like some choreography that's going on, which I think are all hallmarks of a good single take or good one-er.
Yeah, it's a cool moment. One other thing I just wanted to mention was just that this kind of goes back to the idea of like the longing and almost like serendipitous relationship. And you mentioned it, it's that Yeti and Tide, Andy Lau's character, meet later on. And at first I was like, that seemed, you know, like too far-fetched or something, but it kind of explains it that they're in the Philippines and they're in Chinatown in this city, and that it's pretty small and all the Chinese people stay at the same hotel. So it makes sense in that sense that they might run into each other, but they kind of hit it off, and Yeti is passed out on the street, and Tide helps him and takes him to his hotel room. And they have a moment where it feels like they can sense a connection, but they don't know what it is. He says, "Have I met you before?" And he's like, "I don't think so." But it seems like we as the audience know, at least is how I read it, like they have this third party connection through Maggie Chung's character, and they just don't even know it, but they kind of somehow they can sense that there's something there between them. And I thought that was really interesting. And later they find out, and they realize they both know the same woman. But yeah, I thought that was a really cool moment. And I can't quite remember, but again, as we revisit Chungking Express, I think the same kind of thing happens there, but we'll find out.
It's similar. I feel like Chungking Express is more two discrete halves. That are connected by a single moment. And I can't remember if the characters interact other than that. But yes, I'm anticipating getting a chance to revisit that.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see that one again. Well, let's talk about sort of the reaction to this movie. Do you want to talk about that?
And I think that will flow into the discussion of the alternate cut that's on the disc. So,
sure, yeah.
Among general audiences, among its premiere, the reactions were pretty negative. But it found, critics in the critical community outside of that were able to appreciate the film at the time. But that negative reaction is what resulted in sort of last minute edits to emphasize Tony Leung's involvement, which is why in the alternate cut that's on the disc, there is a scene at the beginning that is essentially an echo of the scene that's at the end of the film that brings in Tony Leung's character much sooner.
As it stands, it's really odd because it's like this character we've never met, and he ends the movie and it's just him getting ready, and it's very mysterious, and it feels like, okay, this is leading to something, and then it doesn't. But yeah, go on.
Well, apparently initially there was a planned sequel that would have been made had it not been for the fact that the film didn't do well in terms of box office. And so that, I guess, was the idea of, I have it in my notes here. This is from David Bordwell. And like, so in 2008, David Bordwell, I guess, got a copy of this alternate cut and wrote a piece about it on his blog. You can find it on there. So he says, most critics have also accepted Wong's explanation that he had planned a sequel, one showing Yeti's influence over others lingered long after his death. Patrick Tam told Stephen Tao that the shot was his idea, a setup or trailer for the next film, turning everything he had seen up until now into a lengthy prologue. But Days of Being Well was a fiasco with the box office, taking in Hong Kong 9.7 million, or about 1.25 million US, in a year in which Stephen Chow's All for the Winner earned over four times that. So the sequel was never made.
Huh. Yeah, that's super interesting. And that does help explain it. And Maggie Cheung, in the interview that she has on the disc, sheds a little bit of light on it too. She says that the original plan was to film them both at the same time, but it was like planned as two movies. And like the financing ran out, and maybe like early screen tests weren't doing well or something like that. And the financer cut them off. And so, they basically ended up having to scrap it and never were able to return to it because it didn't perform well. But she says she actually filmed several scenes with Tony Leung that were for this second part, that never came out. So that was really interesting. And yeah, so the alternate cut has him, I can't, even as the first shot, I think, from what I read, like he's a lot in the beginning, or at least it kind of hints at who he is.
Yeah. It starts with the scene that's at the end of the film now, and it's him sort of filing his fingers, and then it cuts to like this gambling den, and the character Tide is there in some capacity. And we don't know why. And there's like a card game going on. There's a man with a stake, and there are these quick cuts of the snake slithering around. And there's a close up of a hand smoking a cigarette. And so this is also from the David Bordwell blog post about this alternate cut. But he says the shots with Andy Lau in a card game and fighting afterwards were done in the very early stage of the film's lengthy shoot, in which Lau was playing a gangster-like character in the Kowloon walled city. The role and much of the original concept of Days of Being Wild were reprised in Jeff Lau's Days of Tomorrow, 1993. Andy's character was later changed to that of a cop. So I guess because the story changed after they shot the footage, that was one reason for cutting it. But after the test audiences or the film didn't premiere well, they added, more footage of the stars to the front end for this alternate cut so that they could hopefully sell it more easily without having to explain necessarily why, this character is different. And also, it's weird because like there is this voiceover. So the end of the film as it is with the Tony Leung character, it's just an extended version of what's on the front end with the Tony Leung character. It's him in the room getting ready. It's like that same environment, it's just more of that footage. But at the end of the film, there's a voiceover and it's never clear who is speaking and who they're talking about.
Interesting. That's only in the alternate cut, you're saying, because I don't remember it.
Well, the voiceover is in both versions, really clear. Like, if you recall, it's a character saying something like, that was the last time I saw him after he came back from the Philippines or something like that.
I assume that was Tide, but yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, so it could be Tide or it could be the Tony Leung character. Also, what makes it even more confusing in a good way is that Michelle Chung's character, Maggie Chung's characters has the same name as her character in 2046 and in The Mood for Love.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So, because I read like within just a minute of each other, there was planned to be a sequel, but that never happened. But then this is also part of a loose trilogy with those two other movies. So maybe I won't fully understand that until I see those other two. But is it just the character's name? Is there more carryover? Is it kind of just a spiritual sequel? How does that work?
My understanding is that between Days of Being Wild and In the Mood for Love is a spiritual sequel. So, for example, like the Tony Leung character is not the same, necessarily the same character that is in The Mood for Love. But In the Mood for Love and 2046 are much more closely linked. And some people see it as a direct, see 2046 as a direct sequel to In the Mood for Love. But it is open for interpretation. Like the way the films are put together, you can read into it what you want. So it doesn't have to be a direct sequel. It could be a thematic or a spiritual sequel. They all explore sort of similar themes. They're all period pieces. And they all sort of deal with these same issues of longing and memory and regret and things.
Well, I'm excited to watch the rest of those. I've heard, you know, such high praise for In the Mood for Love forever. So I'm excited to finally watch that. It'll be a few movies away. Yeah, so I guess we kind of ran through what's on the disc. I did watch both of those interviews. Let me see if there's anything else interesting from those. Oh, in the Christopher Doyle interview, he's kind of addressing a crowd at a Q&A or something, but he talks about that final scene. So Tony Leung is in like a room with a very low ceiling, and the camera's kind of gliding back and forth. And he explains it's because he was carrying this camera in this low room and he could barely keep it up. So he as he's watching it, and it, like, it shows us, he's like, okay, now my right leg was super tired. Now my left leg was super tired. So I'm going back and forth. It looks beautiful, just like an interesting shot, but that was kind of some funny background there. And he said that, so this is one of his first, if not his first feature that he ever did. And he said that Maggie Cheung hated him for a long time because they had to do so many takes for him, because he was kind of like getting the shot right. And he talked about there's some like elaborate 5 minute long, maybe not that quite that long, but like a long sequence that they had to do over and over and over and over because he, as a cameraman, was having to adjust things. And then they ended up cutting the scene anyway. So he felt really bad about that. I thought that was kind of funny. He talked about that train station shot. One other just interesting thing. So they're in the Philippines, and apparently one of the characters kind of in the background as this crowd comes in is the daughter of the Filipino president. That's kind of interesting little cameo thing. And then in the Maggie Cheung interview, it's just audio and it's kind of showing scenes from the movie as it's playing. But she says that Days of Being Wild is maybe her favorite movie she's ever been in. I thought that was kind of cool. She talked about people in the 60s kind of having an aimlessness, like the tempo of life is slower is the way she put it. And that's kind of plays into it, to this movie. The sequel would have taken place 6 years later, but they would have both been released at the same time, but like or close at the same time, but a 6 year gap in between the movies, and that she did many of the scenes with Tony Leung, as I mentioned before, but the financing didn't play out. And then she just mentioned that a lot of the viewers thought it was kind of slow and boring. They may have been expecting an action movie from this person who just made As Tears Go By a few years before. But she says she really likes it, and she actually hates action movies. She said she hates doing them and she hates watching them. Of course, she's in Police Story with Jackie Chan, so that's kind of a funny thing. It showed like clips of her in that as she's saying she hates action movies. Oh, that was kind of funny. So I think that's kind of the main things out of that one. And then of course the alternate cut we talked about. And so I guess that kind of gets us to the end of the supplements there. Anything else about Days of Being Wild that we should discuss before we wrap up?
I think just that everybody needs to go out and watch it as soon as possible. Yes. Don't be dissuaded by potential spoilers. I don't think did we really spoil anything?
I don't think so. Like, so the fact that he does, at least find his birth mother, even if they don't connect, but I don't think that's really a major spoiler. There's some stuff at the end we did not spoil.
Yeah. That, you know,
some surprises there.
On Switchblade Sisters, April Wolf used to have this thing where she would always say, remember, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes the film worth watching. And that's kind of my motto. So the unfolding of the events in the film was only part of it.
Yeah.
So
I think especially in the movies, like by really, really good directors like this, it's almost unspoilable in a way. I don't know. Like if there's like some major twist, I wouldn't want to know, but yeah, I think, I don't think there's really anything to be spoiled necessarily about this movie. And I think it's fantastic. And I'm just really excited to get into the rest of these. And I think these are like, I enjoyed it watching it, but then like the after the fact thinking through it and even like taking notes for this podcast really enriches it and these Criterion supplements. So like this is the kind of movie that I think is really made even better by kind of the discourse around it. And this is the reason that the Criterion kind of set is a great way to experience these movies. So anyway, yes, highly recommend Days of Being Wild. I'm excited because Leslie Cheung is going to come back in Happy Together, and maybe another one, I can't remember, but I think of course we'll have Maggie Cheung and Tony Leung and a few other things. So excited to see them again. Next in the marathon is going to be Chungking Express, which is, I think when I first heard of Wong Kar-wai, I heard about In the Mood for Love and Chungking Express. So I don't know if this is like one of his most major films or something. They're certainly the most, I think there's a lot of supplements because Criterion previously had a standalone for this one. So I think there's a lot to watch as far as extra features. So I'm going to try to cut out some time to watch all of those things. But yes, I'm really excited to watch this again. And I think, yeah, it should be good. Do you have any kind of initial thoughts as before we watch Chungking Express, things to watch for or anything like that?
I would just say pay attention to the bifurcated nature of the story because it is two distinct halves. Other than that, I think it's been several years since I've seen it, so I'm excited to watch it again.
Yeah, me too. And I remember a sequence that dealt with a toy airplane that was really memorable. So I'm excited to, I don't remember exactly what's going on around it, but I remember it being really cool. So that's
I feel like Chungking Express will be the first time that we'll really be able to talk about the changes that are a result of, the restorations of this set, because I believe that they are more significant than what they have been to this point.
Okay, interesting. I'll try to do some digging around that too and bring some information, but yeah. And I know there's side-by-side comparisons and things out there that people have done, so I'll try to find those and link to them. And speaking of linking to things, for this one, I do have the David Borden...
The
David Bordwell essay or article about the restoration. And also someone on moviecensorship.com did a little post that does some comparison side-by-side shots and things, so I'll link to that as well. Well, cool. That is Days of Being Wild. Thank you again so much, Omaya, for being here. And we'll talk to you next time.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, as always, to Omaya for being here. And that will do it for this doozy of an episode. We've only been doing two films per episode for a little while now, but I don't think I've ever loved both movies quite as much as I love both of these. The Green Knight and Days of Being Wild are now definitely among my favorite films. So this has been a pleasure. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links to the Bentonville Film Festival and the Fort Smith Film Festival. And with that, thank you for listening to Art House Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes now, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. You can learn more at appallingproductions.com or find a link in the show notes. If you want to support Art House Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Art House Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Art House Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Art House Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.